I work with many governments. Since years, I have discussions, advice, debates with the government leaders around the world, developing, developed world. I have my golden rule number one in energy is diversification. One shouldn't rely on one single country, one single route. We saw state of Hormuz, for example, one single technology, diversify as much as possible. This is my golden rule. Don't put all the eggs in one basket.
Welcome to Leaders Unplugged, real talk with the impactful. I'm David Bach, your host. Today, our guest is Dr. Fatih Birol, Executive Director of the International Energy Agency. In a time of so much focus on the role of energy, the explosion of demand due to AI, and limitations on supply due to geopolitics, I wanted to speak with Dr. Birol to understand what leaders have to know about the global energy market right now, how energy functions as a weapon, and what the closure of the Strait of Hormuz means in the long term, where we are in the transition to renewables, and why he believes that we're entering the age of electricity. And also what Fatih Birol, who grew up in Turkey and is a passionate supporter of his hometown soccer club Galatasaray, thinks about the position of Europe and the race towards a sustainable future. Here now is my conversation with Fatih Birol. Can you give us sort of a big picture assessment? What are some of the key issues on the demand side and the supply side when it comes to energy globally that you think everyone should understand?
Now, energy is the lifeblood of the economy, our daily life, how we go to work, how we work at home. We need energy, electricity. We understood the critical importance of energy or how essential it is when we hit, for example, COVID-19. But one of the biggest challenges I see today in many parts of the world, especially in Africa, more than 600 million people have no electricity. And around the world, in Africa, Latin America, and Asia, people to prepare their food, they use cook stoves run by wood, agricultural waste, animal waste, which creates respiratory diseases for women because they prepare the meal. And for example, in Africa, every year, more than 800,000 women die prematurely because of the respiratory diseases caused by this lack of clean energy cooking. So energy is very important for the whole world, but some parts of the world do not have this yet the luxury to have access to energy.
And when you look big picture, how should we think about demands, drivers of demand, and, you know, the sort of big trends on the supply side that people should be aware of?
So on the demand side, we see that almost all the fuels are growing very strongly, oil, gas, in some countries even coal, but renewables make a huge move. But when I look at the entire picture, what I see is that the electricity is growing much faster than anything else. When you look at the history of energy, the Industrial Revolution, for example, was fueled mainly by coal. So remember the novels of Emile Zola, for example, the workers bringing from coal mines to the factories. So it was the age of coal. Then, especially after the Second World War, the oil and then natural gas were the main supplier of the global economy. It was the age of oil and gas. And now, as I claimed 2 years ago, I think we are entering the age of electricity because electricity demand is growing very fast. Total energy demand grows as well, but electricity demand grows 2.5 times faster than the total energy demand. Why it is the case, we see it around the world. Not only developing countries, but developed countries as well. For example, in Europe or United States, electricity demand was flat many years, and now it is increasing. So what are the drivers of the why suddenly electricity demand is growing so strongly, and why I call it the age of electricity? There are basically three drivers of that, additional drivers. Number one, the artificial intelligence and databases, they need a lot of electricity. And today, in my view, the artificial intelligence is the most consequential technological innovation to date. And there's a big race among the countries, US, China, Europe, and the others, whoever wins the AI race will get the upper hand in the geopolitics and global economy as well. But for the databases, which is the heart of the artificial intelligence, you need 24/7 electricity. So this is the one major driver, lots of data centers, therefore lots of electricity. Second, electric cars sales are skyrocketing. 5 years ago, only 5 years ago, of the all the cars sold in the world, 5% was electric. And this year, 30% of all the cars sold are electric. And they are not sold because of the environmental reasons, climate change reasons. They are sold because they are getting cheaper and user-friendly. Third, and globally, the most important reason why electricity demand is growing, and I call it the age of electricity, is that the number of air conditioners around the world, especially in the developing world, is growing very strongly. In the United States today, or in Japan, 90% of the households have an air conditioner, and in Nigeria it is 5%. Indonesia 18%, India 20%. With the increasing temperatures and increasing income levels, people buy before car an air conditioner. So all these three new elements, the AI, electric cars, and the air conditioners, give a big boost to electricity demand, and therefore I call it we are entering the age of electricity.
So you mentioned this rise in demand for electricity, also, of course, the growing role of renewables, which seem to be powering a lot of the increase in demand for electricity. So, you know, if you go back, I mean, the history of energy in many ways is the history of burning stuff, right? Even before coal, it was wood and so on. Are we about to transition from a world in which energy was about burning stuff to a world in which we can generate abundant electricity with renewables? How close are we to this? Is that overblown, or is that really within our grasp?
It is happening, but not as fast as some people think. Energy sector is a bit different than the other parts of the economy. For example, in the IT sector, when we have a phone, we change it every 2 years, 1 year, and so on. But energy changes happening rather slowly because it's a huge system. If I can tell you, in terms of transportation, the IT is like how a bicycle moves. Energy sector is like a big tanker. If it changes the destination, it takes some time. So lots of things happening in the energy sector. For example, renewables, you mentioned last year, of all power plants in the world installed, 75% were renewables. Solar, followed by wind, 25%, everything else put together, nuclear, coal, gas, whatever. But the energy system is so huge that this growth for the new ones are making a slow dent in the total mix. But it is in everybody's benefit to make this transition, almost everybody's benefit, I should say, to make this transition faster. Some of the numbers I see in terms of the cost of renewables give me hope that it can be faster, especially solar. 15 years ago, when I talk about solar, it was a romantic story. And now it is the main business. People go for that. And it is not necessarily for the solar being environmentally friendly, for basically two reasons. They are getting cheaper. And second, energy security makes the renewables very preferable for many, many countries. They prefer it because you generate it at home rather than importing from somewhere else. Yes, transition is happening, but not as fast as some of us would like to see.
What does electrification do to an economy? You mentioned energy security. You also started talking about costs. People still continue to think of renewables perhaps as more expensive. What does an electrified economy look like? How does it compete differently?
Electrified economy would be more efficient, more secure, and it will change a lot of habits we have. And also industrial sector will be much more driven by the processes run by electricity. And all in all, there will be a big transformation that the electricity will dominate the game. In some countries, it's faster. In some countries, it's slower. For example, Today, China is the leader, but Japan and Korea are also very, very strong here. Whereas countries like United States or Canada or Australia, major fossil fuel producers, they are a bit slower. The funny thing is, as I said in the recent interview, Europe, you should think Europe as a continent, which is not a fossil fuel producer, the share of electricity would be similar to that of Korea, Japan, and China, but Europe electrification rate is close to United States, Australia, and Canada. So it is the reason I believe the European energy system should be electrified for the reasons of the economy, for the reasons of the energy security and the competitiveness of Europe.
I think the case is so compelling. I read recently that Europe still imports 50% of its energy in the form of fossil fuels, spends 300 billion euros a year on that, when that money could be going into electrification to achieve that efficiency, the lower cost, the greater reliability, and the security. What do you see as the main obstacles? Is it technology? Is it capital? Is it policy? Is it lack of interconnection? Where would you emphasize to accelerate that transformation in Europe in particular?
So for Europe, first of all, I should say the electrification is important before anything, especially when we look at the world today, becoming dangerous, more and more dangerous by day, it is a sovereignty issue. So if you generate your own electricity, you don't need to import your gas or X, Y, and Z from other countries so that your country is not vulnerable to what happens geopolitically, and nobody can use energy as a leverage against your country. In the past, Europe made major mistakes, and today, if Europe has a major competitiveness problem and also reliant on other countries, it is because of the, in my view, three strategic mistakes Europe has made, historic mistakes. One of them is over-reliance on one single fuel, on one single country, which is Russia. Second, I have to tell this, not many people may agree with me, but Europe in 1990s, about one-third of the European electricity came from nuclear power. Europe turned its back to nuclear power, and today it is going to down to about 15%, slowly but surely. We lost this edge. And third, a few minutes ago, I mentioned the solar being the dominant choice in entire energy system, and today 85% of solar panels are manufactured in China. But 20 years ago, it was Europe who started the solar adventure. It was Germany, Spain, Italy put subsidies, but it was expensive. But in a few years, Europe dropped the ball and China took it over, and China dominates the game now. Otherwise, it would have been Europe who was would be a major player. But developing a technology is something like running a marathon. A marathon is 42 kilometers. If you finish the first 10 kilometers as the number one in the race, like Europe did in solar, nobody remembers you. People will remember who gets the gold medal after 42 kilometers. You have to have consistent policies, and Europe didn't have it. I tell you something, which is a very disturbing data for me at least. Europe last year broke a record of adding a major amount of renewables. Very good. Never seen before. However, three times of what we installed last year, renewables were ready, but because of lack of grid, they were not able to connect to the grid. They are just ready. The power plant, the solar or windmills or offshore wind, they were ready. They were finished, but the grid capacity was completely full. So this is a major problem, and this is therefore we need to build more grids. So in front of the electrification in Europe, I see a policy challenge and also having not enough grids challenge.
Does this afford opportunities to emerging markets that don't have as much deployed infrastructure? People talk about decentralized solar, for example. In Pakistan, you're seeing solar panels going up on the roofs everywhere. People sometimes invoke the comparison to how parts of Africa jumped right over fixed telephony and went straight to mobile telephony because, of course, it was more advanced and you didn't need to deploy a whole lot of infrastructure. Are you a big believer in decentralized renewable energy as a key to emerging markets catching up on energy?
Yeah, of course, especially in the rural areas in the Asia, in Africa. Instead of building big grids, it is if we have the solar panels or different applications or wind, it is good. But if you look at the cities, big industry facilities, you need more central electricity systems. When you say Africa, for example, one of the things, I know I shouldn't give too many numbers, but one number which disturbs me a lot from an ethical point of view, leave aside the energy, I mentioned today that in Africa, half of the population, they don't have electricity. The day finishes for them much earlier than anybody else. But solar electricity, which is very cheap today, the solar radiation, the most is in Africa, the quality and the quantity of solar. Yet, the amount of solar electricity we generate in the entire sub-Saharan Africa is less than solar electricity we generate in Belgium. So think about the map, okay? The Africa and Belgium, with all respect to Belgium, and the solar electricity is getting cheaper, and the people have no electricity. This is really disturbing, at least for me, a disturbing fact.
What do you say to people who say to accelerate that electricity revolution, at least in the short term, it means, as you said, solar from China, EVs from China, batteries from China. Is that a concern? I know it is in Europe. Should it be a concern elsewhere that we're potentially substituting one dependency that you mentioned, natural gas from Russia, to a very heavy industrial dependency on China?
So I work with many governments since years. I have discussions, advice, debates with the government leaders around the world, developing, developed world. I have my golden rule number one in energy is diversification. One shouldn't rely on one single country, one single route. We saw Strait of Hormuz, for example, one single technology. Diversify as much as possible. This is my golden rule. Don't put all the eggs in one basket. Countries, regardless of whatever the country it is, may or may not use it as a leverage to against your government, your company, and others. So diversifying is key here. Even if they don't use it as a leverage in the negotiations of something, they have an upper hand in those negotiations. So diversify as much as possible. And this will be my advice.
You mentioned the Strait of Hormuz. We can all see the short-term implications in terms of gasoline prices and futures on oil. What do you think are the medium and long-term implications of the weaponization of the Strait of Hormuz by Iran and its closure?
So Strait of Hormuz is a reminder, I should say, a bitter reminder to everybody. When you apply for a post at the IAEA, okay, when somebody applies, I don't have much time now, but when I interview the people, I have two standard questions. One of them is, why did you apply for this job? Because I want to understand, they want to apply for the IAEA or they want to live in Paris. So we are in Paris, so I want to understand what is their motivation. But the second question of mine has been since years, what are the first three things you would do if the Strait of Hormuz is closed? This was a major thing for us as a...
You've been asking people this for a while.
Since years. Because we are an organization which looks after global energy security. And this has been, in my view, the Achilles heel of the global energy system. Because the huge amount of oil and gas and also fertilizers goes from that strait. And it is, in my view, it is not logical that the $140 trillion global economy hinges on a 50 kilometer of a strait, which is in a very, very difficult part of the world. So it reminds us that it is a big risk to have a over-reliance on, as I said, a certain trade route, certain country and others. So what will be the implication of this many, many changes in the energy policies, in the technologies, partnerships? But if I have to pick up one thing, I would believe that when I look at the world today, the most scarce commodity in the energy world today is trust. So countries will look at their partners. If I have a agreement to build a, nuclear power in my country, shall I import this from country A or B? Normally, I go for the country which offers the cheaper option. But now I will think, I can do this, but maybe instead of paying €3 to this cheap option, I pay the other one €4 that is not going to use this as a political leverage to me. So there will be energy security risk premium, and the trust will be a major factor in the choices of energy policies, partners, and others.
This is the way we think about globalization more generally here at IMD, that it used to be a story primarily about efficiency, and increasingly it's about reliability, and people will pay a premium for reliability. Exactly. Let me ask you just a question on your own trajectory. You've been at the IEA since 1995. You've led it for 10 years. It's a multilateral organization. It advises on policy based on data and evidence. And I think, you know, both multilateralism and evidence-based policy have been under a lot of pressure around the world. How do you deal with that personally? And how do you get your team focused on doing this work when, you know, there is so much mistrust about both multilateralism and data-based policy recommendations?
So IEA has an impeccable credibility with the advanced economies, with the developing countries, with the businesses, with the NGOs, because we have a motto, no fear, no favor. We look at the data and we tell whatever it costs. We talk about nuclear. I have been saying in Germany since years that it was a mistake, Germany, to phase out a nuclear power plant. And I had a lot of bruise here coming from Berlin and elsewhere. And the same thing for other countries. I can give you many examples like that. But these things, what you say that it is wrong or right, gives you the long-term credibility. IEA has a big credibility today, and you are right. The multilateralism is not going through easy days. But thanks to our credibility, I am very happy that IEA is now well-protected and doing its job. And I have an amazing team at IEA. Because when I choose my team, I have one and only one motto, criteria, and I have announced it as when I became the head of this agency 10 years ago, it is the meritocracy. So how I choose people, how I extend their contract or end their contract, if I have to, it is based on the meritocracy. And we have a very good team here in a very friendly family environment, unlike many bureaucratic international organizations. And we are very happy and we are very busy as well.
You mentioned the great team you have. I know another team you care a lot about is Galatasaray.
Yes.
What's your prediction for the upcoming season?
Champion again, yeah. This is
wonderful.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for doing this great work and thank you for sharing it with us today.
Thank you very much.
Leaders Unplugged is a co-production of IMD and Remote Daily. This episode was produced by Frank Tabouring, Delia Fischer, Felix Seltner, and Robert Debus. Subscribe to Leaders Unplugged on your favorite podcast platform. I'm David Bach. See you soon.